This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Gongwer News Service publisher John Lindstrom on the strange circumstances surrounding Governor Rick Snyder's State of the State address this week. But first, it's become fairly routine to hear that a newspaper is cutting staff, but that news recently hit close to home. MLive announced they were eliminating 29 positions statewide. That will include some changes at the Kalamazoo Gazette. We're going to discuss the future of the newspaper industry with two Western Michigan University professors. Rick Gershon is co-director of the Telecommunications and Information Management Program in Western School of Communication. Sue Ellen Christian's a former staff writer for the Chicago Tribune, as well as other newspapers, and now a professor of journalism in Western Michigan University's School of Communication. Thank you both for being here.
Good to be with you, Gordon.
Is this just a national trend that newspapers around the country are trying to figure out how to maintain the bottom line? And at the end of the day, labor costs are always the biggest piece of the budget, and that's what goes.
Absolutely. I think that what you find is that this is a trend that we're seeing everywhere nationally, but not only nationally, internationally as well. And part of the problem is the fact that for the last 15 years, what we've seen is a slow, steady elimination of newspapers or decline in newspapers, not for lack of readership, because I think people generally like readership. It's just a question that sometimes the news that's made available for free, nothing beats free.
And I would add to that that while there is strong readership and strong circulation, the readers are aging. And so when we look at the demographics for the future of newspapers, it doesn't look strong.
And there's been all sorts of funding sources which have dried up over the years. Classified advertising, one of the biggest, that used to be a pretty big part of what newspapers earned. And that has all gone to other places for the most part, correct?
Back in the day, 80% of many newspapers' revenues were from classified ads. And then something called Craigslist came along and blew that revenue model out of the water. And papers were really left struggling with how do we make up that chunk. And they've done a yeoman's job of trying to diversify their funding stream, but nothing has taken the place of those classifieds. And while digital ad revenues continue to rise, and as to the circulation, it's not making up those dramatic losses. And so you get things like layoffs and buyouts and things that hurt the bottom line, the numbers in a newsroom. The newsrooms nationwide in America have lost almost 20,000 reporters since 1990. We're at 36,700 as of last year.
So that is that many fewer people keeping an eye on what's happening in your community.
I think what you're seeing also is a lack of, I think the quality of reporting has, you know, taken a very, very hard hit because you're seeing it more at the local level. I think certain national newspapers are being able to maintain a certain business model like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, because they have the staff and they have the pay model that allows them to continue doing more or less what they've been doing. But when you look at news coverage at the local level, I think we've seen a dramatic decrease in the level and depth of news reporting.
But you mentioned the pay model there. The New York Times has got a subscription model. There are some Gannett papers. The Battle Creek Inquirer is one. You get so many articles free a month, and if you want more than that, you pay something. I think Holland Sentinel and the St. Joseph Benton Harbor Herald Palladium have similar type models. Are more newspapers going to have to start thinking about that if they're going to get the revenue to avoid big layoffs, to have the staffs to cover news well?
I think that what you're seeing is a dual model. I think most of your better-run newspapers are trying to do, obviously, both a print version as well as a digital version. And I think the best examples are the ones that are able to adopt both. But it's clearly now, I think, the transition is towards news as a service rather than news as a publication. And so when you look at the examples that you cited, they're doing well, but they're still also struggling, even though, you know, they're probably better examples of what this model tries to represent. I think the real issue is that, you know, digital lifestyle, and I guess that's the best term that I can use to describe it, is here to stay. And this idea of creative destruction when you have new media comes along and somehow outpositions the old media. Sometimes in the past, certainly old media can reposition itself. So when television came along, radio had to reinvent itself. And when television and cable came along, television had to reinvent itself. But I think we're seeing a really tough situation in terms of newspapers really trying to reinvent themselves because there are just so many other news alternatives. Not necessarily better alternatives, but just that there is news information out there.
But perhaps easier alternatives in the sense that all you have to do is turn on your computer as opposed to going to the newsstand and plunking down some money for the newspaper or that you might have bought in the past.
Well, mobile delivery is the number one form of delivery for news now, and that's how people want to get their news. Something like 39 of the top 50 digital news websites have most of their traffic from mobile devices. What's interesting to me is, for example, the New York Times, their average time when someone accesses their website or a related app on their mobile, the average time that someone spends looking at that page or that site is 4.6 minutes. They're not reading the paper. They're doing a quick drive-by. They're linking because Gordon put on his Facebook page, hey, there's an interesting story. I want to just quick take a look at it. But according to the State of the Media 2015, they looked at local news because of just what we're talking about here. And the number one way that people want their local news is a newspaper. So I think people have to put their money where their mouth is and decide that they're willing to pay for either the digital paywall. Yep, I'll pay after my five articles are up for the month. If that's the kind of subscription model that we would see locally, that's certainly what we've seen in other places. Be willing to pay a little bit more for the print version because no one else is going to cover Kalamazoo. And the bigger statewide papers, the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, and the national papers, it's not where their orientation is. So if we want to know what's going on in Kalamazoo or at City Hall, we are really dependent on our local news staff to let us know that. And I think that they, for example, MLive, in your lead-in, you mentioned their cuts. And I think that the few remaining people there, or the however many are remaining, they're doing an incredible job with the the resources that they have. They're doing watchdog journalism in the sense that they're covering City Hall, they're covering county government, they're covering the sorts of entities that are using taxpayers' money. So I think they're making wise decisions locally in terms of coverage, but it's really difficult to do it all.
I think the other thing I would add to that is that the public hasn't really yet fully knows how to really engage news stories online. So then when you talk about stories about local government, and the examples that I see very much is during the summer months when we're talking about millages and tax proposals, and all of a sudden things happen in August and people just aren't aware of it. And the next thing you know, a millage passes and people sort of wonder why that happened. Well, back in the day when the Kalamazoo Gazette was a daily newspaper, this was a topic of discussion. And so people really were fully engaged in the story. And you got a sense that people really at least knew the issue so that if they wanted to vote, they voted with some degree of understanding. Now things just kind of happen, behind the scenes. And I think that's really one of the really unfortunate parts of what we're seeing right now.
The Columbia Journalism Review, in their article about the cuts at MLive, noted that it's hard not to feel concerned about the journalistic resources available in Michigan. This is a quoting from their article, a state that ranks near the bottom for the State Integrity Report Card in 2015 from the Center for Public Integrity. At what point do we notice, and maybe we don't, it could be the real problem, that we don't notice the lack of a watchdog to tell us what's happening at City Hall until it's too late?
Yeah, there's never been a better time to be a corrupt local politician because, not that Kalamazoo has any, but I would just say that the watchdog role of news outlets is obviously suffering because of the numbers are diminishing. As the CJR report noted, at the same time that MLive announced its restructuring, Governor Snyder signed a law that restricts public officials from discussing ballot proposals in the 2 months before an election. And so in terms of if we're relying on our government entities to educate the public in lieu of local newspapers, that was just one blow to that effort.
I do wonder if maybe other watchdog groups might emerge. And for instance, the Flint water story was apparently sort of an independent former journalist working for the American Civil Liberties Union helped uncover part of the problem there. Are there other sort of advocacy groups out there who may say, well, look, there's no newspaper in town, but we need to know, we're going to find out? There certainly may be problems with that, but could it be where we're headed?
I think there's an interesting example with the Philadelphia Inquirer, where you have, you know, an owner who comes along who basically makes a decision and says, okay, we're going to have to approach this very differently. If the pay model is there, if the advertiser model is not fully there, then maybe suddenly newspapers become a community resource where it suddenly becomes everybody's interest to partially own this thing. It's almost like thinking of a newspaper brand as a franchise, not unlike an athletic team where everybody has some investment and ownership in the recognition that that commonly owned newspaper or news service is really for the betterment of the community. The challenge, of course, becomes then how do you pay for this thing? Well, public radio certainly has a long history of knowing how to do this because they've never had to rely on advertising. So you have a long history of knowing how to kind of set the standard for that thing. But I think in a newspaper context where you see that playing out is the fact that I think you're going to start seeing a lot more efforts towards philanthropic support, different kinds of groups coming up and stepping up to provide financial support because there's a belief that there's a value in having this newspaper as a community resource.
I would add that one concern in that is either the professionalism of citizen journalists or advocacy groups. They can be very well-intentioned, but there is a level of professionalism that journalists bring to the task, and just in terms of knowing what documents to look for, how to compare data, and Gordon, your point earlier, per the CJR article, that we are seeing in Michigan an incredible lack of sunshine on our public records. And I think that that doesn't bode well for advocacy groups or others trying to fill in the gaps, which I applaud and I hope we keep seeing in the absence of news organizations being able to fit that bill. I also would like to say I think that it's important for listeners and the news audience to appreciate the fact that what they pay attention to and what they click on matters. And so this whole idea of analytics when it comes to newspapers, the corporate side of the industry necessarily has to track what are people interested in. And every time a reader chooses to click on a lighthearted story or
the latest on the Kardashians.
You're going to get more of that. And it doesn't feel like it's hurting anything when you do it, but those numbers add up and it sends a signal. And if you are trying to sell ads and stay afloat and be digitally relevant, then it does send a message.
I think to Sue Ellen's point, you know, I think the quality of writing and the kinds of stories that are now often featured in the middle of an internet website, news website, and we're talking about some respectable news brands, sometimes surprises me because I think it's speeding more to the analytics than it is to really what's truly newsworthy. And I'm sometimes surprised at the focus on certain stories and certain personalities that really are not necessarily newsworthy, but that have become part of this thing. And I would add that, you know, digital media has a lot of promise, but we're not seeing it yet. I think we're coming up short, and that's kind of disappointing because I think the opportunity is there. When you add integrated video, when you integrate some of the things that truly a good news website can do, we're just not hitting our stride by any means. And so I think we're getting some of it, but we're a ways off. And one other point I would say is that there's a writer some years ago by the name of Andrew Keen who wrote a book called The Cult of the Amateur. And one of his concerns was the fact that everybody who can write and blog and post a news item doesn't necessarily make for a journalist. And sometimes to the uninformed reader, that becomes a problem because what passes as just an opinion is just that, an opinion, but it's not necessarily quality journalism. And quality journalism isn't just about the writer, it's about the news organization itself.
So, what would you say is our best case scenario for where the newspaper industry will be 10 years from now? And what might you think is the worst? I'll let you start, Rick.
Well, I mentioned before the idea of digital lifestyle. That's not going away. If anything, it'll become more so. And as Ellen pointed out about mobility, that's clearly the way news is going to be read by a lot of people going forward. Best case scenario, I think, is the combination of where I'll call it high tech, high touch. On the high touch side, you're hoping that people really will appreciate the value of good digital media so that they can appreciate the thing of having video streaming in the middle of a news story on a good website. But at the same time, I hope that, you know, there's an opportunity for that same person to be able to, on a Sunday morning, pick up his or her newspaper on the front doorstep of their house and be able to read it and recognize as a value of being able to fold that newspaper and sit with it and read with it like they've always had.
Sue Ellen?
I can foresee in a decade that we would maximize the digital power of storytelling with immersive video, with really complex series about difficult subjects that I call it slow journalism. A lot of people in the industry are thinking that way, where you're really going to unpack something. So you're going to read that on your Sunday morning or when you've got some time. It's not a 4.6 minute drive by on your phone. And I think what we'll be seeing more and more with the presence of digital devices and mobile devices capturing video, capturing audio, with Twitter, people are going to do their own news gathering, so to speak, and I hope that what journalists will become are very informed, almost analysts or
fact checkers.
Yeah, wonderful. Yes, we can't keep up with the flow and the speed of social media and what's going on there, and so it means adjusting the way that we've always done things. And I think you can't underestimate the importance of the journalistic role of assessing sources, authenticating them, providing some informed background, and as much as possible neutrality to what's coming across your Twitter feed.
And the one thing I would add to Sue Ellen's point is that, you know, social media is a problem and an opportunity. It's a problem in the fact that, you know, social media can get very, very mean-spirited, you know, and we use the word trollers, people out there who have really just mean things to say and can do so under the guise of anonymity, and that's a very unfortunate part of what we see now with a lot of news stories. But on the upside, you see sort of things that happen with the Arab Spring, where social media can be such an important catalyst to inform people and breaks down the barriers, the walls that have historically separated countries from other countries and people from other people. And when you can have social media and the access to the internet in a way that really does break down those barriers, sometimes you see some important news stories that are getting circulated and the ability to mobilize people to action in a variety of ways.
Rick Gershon and Sue Ellen Christian, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Rick Gershon is co-director of the Telecommunications and Information Management Program in Western Michigan University School of Communication. Sue Ellen Christian is a professor of journalism in WMU's School of Communication, also a former reporter for the Chicago Tribune. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Going where news service publisher John Lindstrom has seen his share of State of the State addresses, but he says that Governor Rick Snyder faces an unprecedented situation when he speaks to a joint session of the legislature. Lindstrom says in a blog post that he can't recall a governor giving such an address while facing the reality that he has lost the confidence of so many and that his administration stands morally indicted. John Lindstrom, thank you for being with us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Obviously, that's a reference to what is going on with the water crisis in Flint. So how big is the shadow over the State of the State address that is cast by what is happening in Flint right now?
You know, a year ago at the State of the State, the governor chose the following imagery to describe what his policy was going to be for a second term, and he called it the River of Opportunity. And given that this crisis involves the Flint River, it's a strange, very strange turnabout for the governor. And as you and I have chatted and as other people have talked about, here was a man who very seriously, just over a year ago, was being considered, some people were urging him to run for president. And he decided not to do so. No one would think anything of him attempting to run for president now. It is an amazing situation. I have never in my life seen a turnaround like this involving a governor. There have been some legislators who've run into some terrible personal problems. but those were personal problems. Those were things that, you know, they ultimately had control over and failed. This is just an amazing mess up, and there are so many disparate elements to it that it is like trying to follow a breeding chart for champion racehorse or something. But this really comes down to the critical element was a person who was in a position because of a policy that the governor supported, made a decision which triggered an unending string of events that ended up creating this crisis. And that crisis was added to by the administration's failure to, in effect, take seriously what people were saying to them. And that demonstrated a level of cavalier attitude and to some degree, even a level of administrative incompetence that people, I think, are going to have to, that I think the administration recognizes and is trying to deal with, whether or not they can fix it in a way that will resolve the problem is very hard to tell. And of course, since we're dealing with a situation that has potential in terms of elevated lead levels, especially in children, the potential of having lifelong effects, in many respects, this problem can't be fixed.
You noted that the last year's state address included that phrase, river of opportunity. As we sit here just a few days before the next address, can you think back a year ago, how different did it feel preparing for the State of the State address with Governor Snyder coming off a reelection win, as you mentioned, some people dropping his name here and there as a presidential candidate? How different does this feel now a year ahead?
Well, he was fresh off an incredibly successful reelection campaign. His policies, whether you supported them or not, were obviously in place. He did not have total success, clearly, with some of his policies. At that time, the big question facing people was, what were we going to do with roads? And he had just come out of negotiation to put on the ballot, obviously, an ungodly, unsuccessful proposal one. But he had come out of negotiations for that. He pitched that during the State of the State. Finding a way of fixing roads was the main issue. There were other issues that were starting to show up on the larger horizon. Even at that time, they were talking about what to do with a looming financial problem to Detroit schools, which got worse and worse as time went on. And, of course, the Flint water situation involving the Flint River, that had been underway since about 6 months before, and you were hearing complaints. People were talking about the water looking bad, tasting bad, smelling bad. And the argument that they were getting back from the administration basically was the water is safe, it's met all federal testing standards, and there isn't anything you should worry about. We know now that there, in fact, were things to worry about. But even at that time, the complaints were mostly having to do with the taste and the overall quality of the water as opposed to a serious health issue. We didn't know at that time about the lead contamination or, indeed, the possibility, which is not yet confirmed, that the water situation may have played a role in an increase in Legionnaires' disease in Genesee County. And since that time, everything has changed. Absolutely everything has changed. It is so striking as to be, as I say, I've been doing this for almost 40 years in one form or another, covering state government, covering state politics. And I cannot think of another circumstance that comes even close to it. And it's just mind-blowing to me that we're watching this now.
You noted that, I want to go back here and read from your blog, the sentence that kind of stands out. What strikes this reporter above all is how horribly humanly sad this has become. Explain what you mean by that.
Who would want to have a situation, a policy that you've enacted, create a situation where people are harmed and harmed in ways that we will not know the consequence for decades to come? As I pointed out, Governor Snyder genuinely adores kids. He loves them. And now you have a situation where, based on, I mean, he didn't turn the tap and turn on the water, and it started coming out of the Flint River. But his policies led to individuals making decisions that did do that. And another irony is, here's a governor who fought to have Medicaid expanded under the Affordable Care Act to allow for people who are working but have lower incomes to get health insurance. That policy has helped people get mammograms, has helped people get tests for high blood pressure, for diabetes. And because of that, you can make a legitimate argument that that policy has saved lives. And yet now, here a policy has had possibly the opposite effect. I mean, one of the things you do have to worry about now is if the Flint River water is in any way related to Legionnaires' disease and an increase in Legionnaires' disease in Genesee County. Well, some people have died from Legionnaires' disease in Genesee County. And there's nothing else that you can say. Every one of us has come to know grief at some point or another. Every one of us has lost someone we loved, or a friend, or even, you know, just somebody that they had high regard for. And you can't think of a more horrible thought that I did something, and because of what we did, people are sick. People are possibly sick, and maybe somebody even died.
Anyone who has interviewed Governor Snyder, you've probably talked to him many more times than I have, but a lot of what he'll talk about is problem solving, that the people of the state of Michigan are his customers, has certainly tried to project the image of the chief executive who is solving problems for the state. How much did that image take a hit with what happened in Flint?
Well, and speaking of that, we did an interview with the governor in December, a year-end interview. And one of the questions that I put to the governor was, what did you learn from the Flint situation? And quite astonishingly to me, the governor said, well, I'm not sure I learned anything, which we included in our story on the interview, in which a number of people caught on to. But I mean, you know, I frankly was amazed by the comment. And I think if nothing else, the governor has learned. And you saw very quickly after that when he announced that Director Wyatt was resigning from the Department of Environmental Quality. He said specifically, we will learn from this and we will make improvements. And so this has changed his image as a person in command, as a person who knows what he wanted to get done and by and large was able to get much of it done, to a person who seems, you know, I don't want to say grasping at straws, but clearly they are having to deal with an infrastructure, an administrative system that in some respects they really hadn't had to deal with before, at least to the level that they've had to deal with, and at least in this way. And day by day now, things are happening. Earlier this week, he called on the National Guard to help distribute water and filters to the residents of Flint. Late last night, he put out a call for the federal government to assist in resolving the problems. And then, of course, following that, Attorney General Schuette announced that he would conduct an investigation. There's a federal investigation at least being considered. So there's no way to really quantify what a contrast there is between this upcoming January 19th and January of 2015 when he spoke to the legislature then. It is completely a 180 situation. You couldn't get a more night and day, light and dark, whatever you want to use, whatever analogy you want to use. You couldn't come up with anything more dramatic than what we've seen.
John Lindstrom, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Lindstrom is the publisher of the Gongra News Service. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.